You're listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. This week, Anchorage Community Mental Health Services.
Hi, we're so happy to be here today on KYUK as part of Wellness Wednesday to talk about Mental Health Awareness Month. My name is Jessica Cochran, and I used to be a public radio producer, so it's pretty fun to be back on the radio. I spent a little bit of time at KYUK once during the Kuskokwim 300, I think. Now I work with Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. And we just wanted to take the opportunity this month, since it is Mental Health Awareness Month, to talk about mental health in general and challenges people face, and most importantly, how to get help if you need it. So we have a few different people here to help us with our conversation this week. We have Julie Thompson and Jennifer Peaks with Bethel Family Services. Hi, guys. And Julie and Jen did a great show at the end of April, kind of talking specifically about COVID-19 and kind of stress and anxiety around that. And they had a lot of really great tips and resources. So if you didn't catch that show, you can search for it on KYUK's website or on the Bethel Family Services website and give that a listen, because it really did have a lot of great information in it. And since they already did that, we're going to talk a little bit more broadly today about more ongoing mental health concerns and the kind of regular challenges that people might face. So in addition to Julie and Jen, we also have on Pete Tallman, who's a therapist working in the Bristol Bay region with Chamai Community Health Center in Naknek. Did I get that right, Pete?
Yeah, sounds great. Good morning.
Morning. And hopefully soon we'll also have Joshua Arvidson, who is the Director of Child and Family Services with Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. So why is an Anchorage organization on the Bethel Radio? We are actually about to change our name to Alaska Behavioral Health. We have offices in both Anchorage and Fairbanks, so the Anchorage name isn't working. And then with telehealth, we also have the ability to serve other people around the state, in addition to the awesome local resources. Not everyone has access to those local health centers like Bethel Health Center and Chamai Community Center, Community Health Center. So, to start our conversation, I wanted to focus on children's mental health. But it seems to me, and I'm not a therapist, I'm not a clinical person, so I want you guys to jump in. It seems to me when you're talking about children's mental health, you're really talking about whole families.
This is Jen. I totally agree. You can't, support a child without supporting their family, their relatives. So the family, the parents, but the siblings too, and even extended family play a big role in the wellness of children.
Pete, how about you? Do you work with whole family systems in your work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. And, to kind of pick up on what Jen said, I think there's also an element of where sometimes the children are the identified issue because there's some behavioral concern at school or something, but it's really more of a family concern. And so it takes a kind of a whole family approach to try to help kids.
And I know that you guys all have a lot of experience in rural Alaska. And sorry, let me just jump back and say it's Bethel Family Clinic, not Bethel Family Services. Sorry about that. I know you guys have years of experience, especially if we added you all up together. Are there kind of typical issues that you end up dealing with families? And I know every family is unique and different, so maybe that's hard to say, but are there kind of, issues that come up again and again that you would deal with often in your work?
Yeah, I guess this is Jen. I guess that's kind of a tough question. You know, like you said, each family, each situation is unique. So even if we see, similar things, it's very unique to the family and individual and what they're going through in that period. I think, the mental health that we see here out in Bethel is not necessarily unique to Bethel, but the experiences may be different than other, places within the state or within the nation.
And Along with that, Jessica, I would, you know, talk about reoccurring issues. When you look at the intergenerational trauma, you know, you're going to see elements that are an extension of that coming up. Substance use disorder, domestic violence, just the limited opportunities that exist in the villages have a huge impact on the family. And so as far as reoccurring issues, I do think that that is something. I was out in Antioch 16 years ago, and those issues continue to be, you know, primary things that end up getting people in our door. And again, often because things have devolved enough that the court systems have ended up being involved. And so I would say that those are definitely some reoccurring themes that we continue to be challenged with.
Pete, do you have anything to add?
No, I would just say that oftentimes, you know, what brings people in is some behavioral concern. You know, what, how we're feeling affects our behaviors. And a lot of times it's the behavioral thing that gets people's attention, whether that's a student in school or in the family, or a parent's behavior is changed. And it may be that there's a behavior, but underneath that behavior, there's other stuff going on. And so the behavior may be what first attracts all the attention, but the issues underneath it might be anxiety or depression or a reaction to exposure to some of the traumatic events, like what Julie was mentioning.
And I think Joshua Arvidson was able to join us now. Joshua is the Director of Child and Family Services for Anchorage Community Mental Health Services. Hi, Josh. You made it.
Yeah, thanks for letting me back in the meeting. I restarted, and now I'm on my phone now instead of my computer.
Okay. So we were just trying to talk about what, you know, some of the typical issues that bring people in for behavioral health services might be, and you know, whether there's kind of differences between more urban and more rural areas, but the things I'm hearing sound pretty universal. I'm not sure how much of that last one you caught, Josh, and if you had anything to add.
I just caught the end of what Kate was talking about, and yeah, those are the same things that bring people in our Anchorage and Fairbanks clinics and from surrounding areas, that really the same kind of needs. The way we provide services and some of the local needs are different, but people are people, and we pretty much face the same challenges no matter where we're at.
I guess I wanted to ask what are some misconceptions people might have about behavioral health services? Or maybe in other ways, like what are the barriers? Are there people that need services that are reluctant to get them? And how do you work with and try to overcome those barriers?
Yeah, this is Jen. Absolutely, there's a lot of barriers for people when you think about mental health. I think there's been such a stigma against acknowledging when you have a mental health concern or you're not as mentally well as you'd like to be. And so asking for help, I think, has been really hard for a lot of people. And especially if you're, you know, emotionally going through a lot of things, it's even harder to ask for help and get the supports you need. I think also where Julie and I are at in Bethel, there's a lot of challenges to just accessing, just logistics of accessing services. Oftentimes you have to come into Bethel, and for us this past winter, it was a huge challenge for travel. We had a lot of snow, we had a lot of ice, we had a lot of wind and everything. Our winter was was a pretty intense winter, and so a lot of people weren't able to come in to receive services. And telehealth does happen out here, but there's barriers with that too.
So since you, I'm sorry, Pete, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say that I think that staffing in rural Alaska is really challenging. And so sometimes there's a lack of providers to provide the services. And then we end up relying more on telehealth and those things to connect with clients. But unfortunately, the same villages that are somewhat disconnected from major routes for airfare or roads are also don't have the best connectivity. And so where you need it most, it might be the most challenging environment to use telehealth.
And you know, I think that in rural Alaska, you guys were way ahead of us on telehealth, in that you've been doing it for years, and we had we did, you know, minimal amounts of it before mid-March, but now have suddenly swapped all the way over. So you have a lot more time and experience with it, I would guess. Have you seen that access get easier or harder as more people are now using telehealth? I mean, I guess I'm curious if, you know, more people are jumping on the limited bandwidth. Has that actually made access harder in the last couple of months? Did anyone notice that?
I can speak to that. I think that definitely with schools being online, you know, schools are trying to do things online, and our clients are trying to see us online, and there's just a lot of overtaxing of the bandwidth. So we've seen some challenges with that where it's gotten harder. We've been doing telehealth for a long time through our clinic, but now we, because of some changes in the regulations, we can see patients from their homes. But that then introduces the challenges of how good their home connectivity is or how much they pay for data. People in rural communities pay very high prices for data, and they certainly do not have unlimited access. So they have to make difficult choices between how much do I let my kid do the school program, or do I make my therapy session? And those are choices that people in urban communities often don't have to face.
Yeah, and along with what you were saying, Pete, you know, GCI did offer, you know, this increase in data, which was awesome, but the villages didn't have access to that. And so, again, and then the other issue is, too, when from home, sometimes home is not a safe place to be engaging from. And so, again, those outlying villages really have unique situations that even with increased access, sometimes those increases and those softening of boundaries don't necessarily help them so much. So that's really frustrating.
And I know Josh can speak to this a little bit, but I know some of our therapists have had the same thing with urban clients that, you know, they're seeing things in therapy sessions via Zoom that they would not have seen before necessarily.
Yeah, and you know, issues around, you know, in a clinic setting, you can, you know who's in the room, who's not in the room. On a telehealth session, that's a little bit trickier. So, and back to your question, Jessica, about like, as more and more of the world goes to this kind of model, you know, what effect does it have? And it's been interesting, particularly in our Fairbanks clinic. You know, we serve clients who are in pretty rural locations. And once you get an hour away from a clinic for a family, you have a problem of access, right? So, cause it's just not practical. So for like, you know, families in the interior who may actually be able to get into a car to get to our clinic, but they're an hour and a half away, we basically, you know, this telehealth transition to telehealth has for some families really improved their ability to access services. I mean, I really started thinking about this actually after a couple conversations with other providers, including Pete, who's on this show today, maybe about a year ago, and he kind of talked me through some of what he was doing and his organization was doing. And I thought this may be something that can help families in less remote areas. But you know, once you get out to Sutton or Talkeetna or down the end of KGB or an hour and a half from Fairbanks, not as rural as other parts of Alaska, you really do have access problems for families. So I'm hoping that this will improve access just kind of across the state for families, this transition.
Yeah. So I guess I want to go back a little bit to the question of barriers and the more like emotional side of what barriers might be keeping people from accessing services. And especially kind of given some of the things that we've talked about, of kind of, you know, via Zoom, you're seeing into people's homes. So I kind of feel like, as you know, I'm a parent, I've sought services for one of my kids, and it's easy to feel like you're being judged, that you're going to be judged. And that, you know, that's a little scary. So I guess I was hoping you could address that and that kind of fear that parents might have if they think their kid is struggling, they would like some help with it, but they maybe have a little bit of that fear.
Yeah, so I mean, a couple of things going back to the idea of accessing mental health. And I think sometimes folks really make it into this really big decision, like, you know, do I need therapy or not? And I just encourage folks to think about it the same way as you would think about your primary care. You know, if you need to go see your pediatrician or your doctor, or you think you just do it. It's not a huge deal. Everyone needs primary care. Everyone needs mental wellness too. And so I would encourage folks to take some of the air out of the balloon on making this a really, really big decision. If you think you need help, just reach out and access it and think about it the same way you would think about your primary care, you know, and just not make it into a bigger issue than it needs to be. And the other thing I'd say too, just as a therapist and working with a team of therapists, is to that idea that like you're going to be judged or perceived a certain way. I mean, in my career, I've worked with over 1,000 families. I've seen everything, and I learned really early in my career to leave my judgments at the door because they don't help anyone. And so I would just encourage families to know that your provider works with families who are dealing with difficult situations all day, every day. And we're kind of all in this together. And I just encourage folks to think about it that way. So, I know others have thoughts too, but.
Well, oh, go ahead, Jen.
Oh, no, I think that's great. I think, and Julie and I had kind of talked about too, that a lot of people separate mental health from physical health, and they see it's easier, like you're saying, to go to the doctor because you have, a cough or you've had a cold for a while. We don't really think about it too much. People go to the clinics or, here to YK. But when it comes to mental health, it's a lot harder. It's, we separate the two, but they go together, like you were saying. It's health, it's all of our health. One thing I was thinking about though, for our area at least, I think one thing that has been difficult is the cultural component. A lot of times, we have clinicians that come in and the turnover rate is really high, and you get people that may not really be familiar with the cultures that are unique to our region. And I think that's pretty intimidating to go to somebody who may not really understand the lifestyle, the beliefs, the systems, even though the person may be, a great clinician. Having a lack of that understanding, I think, can be a really huge barrier. And historically, Julie had brought up that historical trauma. There's been a lot of programs, a lot of, people who meant to do good, but have caused over the years a lot of trauma, a lot of pain. And I think that continues to be a barrier.
And I would just add, that from a kind of philosophical perspective on therapy, therapy is the one place where you should be able to explore things without judgment. And if you do access services and you feel any kind of judgment, that's worth talking to the therapist about. Sometimes the way that therapy is portrayed in movies and television is like, almost as if you're accessing this wise sage who has all the answers. And unfortunately for those of us who are therapists, that's just not the case. we're specialized and trained in this thing, but we're not specialists in you or your family. That's your area of expertise. And so therapy is really a collaborative effort between you and your children and your family as experts in your family, and us as having this specialized training. And through working together, we can often come up with solutions together that would have been impossible for the therapist to ever come up with on their own, and might have been difficult for the family to come up with without the therapist's help. So the idea that therapy is a judgment-free place is really kind of at the core of why it works.
And along with what Jen and Pete were talking about, and I really think, again, in response to what you're talking about, Jessica, is not only do we have our personal beliefs and our personal hesitations around mental health because it has been stigmatized, I think there's a top-down issue with medical, and that is that until we start truly providing integrated care and that we see the same resources for mental health that we see for medical health, and that we see medical providers understanding and investing in what it means to provide a broad range of services, including mental health, that address the whole person, we will continue to have barriers. And that's, again, I've done some trainings with the medical staff in various hospitals, and behavioral health is this thing over here that nobody they kind of want to refer to, but they don't want to have anything to do with. And you cannot separate medical and mental health. They are intertwined, and there's a lot of research around when you start addressing mental health issues, how it impacts our autonomic nervous system and our ability to develop neural pathways that increase our own sense of well-being. And so, again, this idea of them being separate is so antiquated, and we really need to start looking at integrated health from a top down, so it makes it more accessible for people.
The phrase intergenerational trauma has come up a couple of times. What does that mean? Can someone describe more specifically what you mean when you're talking about intergenerational trauma? And I guess the reason that question came to me now is because we're talking about, you know, mental health and physical health are integrated, and trauma impacts your brain and the way it develops. And I'm sure someone else can talk about much more wisely than I can, but that is a physical thing. That's one of those.
It is a physical mm-hmm. thing. And in fact, what they found is that they've done even research around Holocaust survivors, and they've actually been able to see changes in people's DNA two or three generations down from the person who had experienced the first generation trauma event. And so, it's a very physical situation that over time, we actually had a conversation the other day with one of my friends who identifies as she's Ojibwe, and her grandmother was in a boarding school, and she was just basically saying how that she's at this point trying to reclaim some of her heritage and her what is culturally significant for her. But when your language has been lost and there's not anyone left to teach you, the songs and the traditions, she's suffering a lot over that. And I think sometimes there's this impression that we just need to get over it and get on with life. But intergenerational trauma is really a cracking of the foundation of a whole culture. And so part of rebuilding that is acknowledging that this trauma happened and that it continues to have not only a cultural impact, but it has a neurologic impact, it has a physical impact. And so again, part of why we continue to cycle through with these problems around mental health, addiction, and physical health, that it's not, again, something that we just, provide compensation and everybody should get on with it. It's much more complex than that. And again, acknowledging that these are things that are very complex and require a lot of sensitivity because there's still so much that we're just trying to figure out about it.
So what do you think therapy can do to help break those cycles? We've talked about those cycles a few times, Julie, but you guys all do the work you do because you think it can make a difference. So what is it that you do that you think that is helping to break those cycles?
I think for me personally, it's been a lot of collaborating with people who know way more than me and are from here. You know, the communities, the leaders here in our region, we have so many, and there's been a lot of kind of grassroots efforts to work through that historical trauma. There's programs at AVCP and ONC, and within each of the communities around here, they're finding unique, culturally appropriate ways to work with each other, to work with the families and kids. And I think that's, you know, the most important. I can see an individual client in my office, but if we're not connecting with the real leaders and role models in the region, we're not going to get too far.
And one of the things that happens with something like intergenerational or historical trauma is that sometimes people feel a certain way but don't understand why they feel that way. Or there's certain problems that are coming up for them. And sometimes the reasons that we tell ourselves why a problem is happening to us is based in some sense that we're different than other people, or there's something wrong with us, or we feel some degree of shame. And the importance of talking about things like intergenerational trauma is partly in just understanding where something comes from and having explanation for it that helps people understand that this isn't something necessarily that's wrong with them as much as it's a reaction to wrong things that they've experienced. And sometimes people that have been through terribly difficult circumstances and have understandable reactions based on those circumstances that they've been through tend to personalize and feel guilty or responsible in ways that are not only not healthy, but just not accurate. And so sometimes in talking about things like intergenerational trauma, we help people realize that it's actually much bigger than them, that these are systemic experiences that oftentimes whole cultures have experienced. And that can be really important and liberating for people to see that and to grieve that and work through the feelings that are associated with it.
And so you kind of brought that around. I was going to ask, you know, about kind of the how do you deal with intergenerational or historical trauma versus personal trauma? Are there different ways that you work with someone to address those? And how, maybe how is that different in different age ranges? You know, I know in Anchorage, we work with a lot of really young kids, and maybe you guys do also, who have had, you know, a lot of trauma by the time they're 3 or 4 years old. And I imagine working with that age person is pretty different than if you are working with them as an adult and they maybe don't even know where, like you were saying, Pete, don't even know where some of those feelings are coming from.
So, you know, just talking again, Jessica, that's a good point. There's actually different kinds of trauma. It can be one event. It can be intergenerational. There's complex trauma, which is usually something that starts early on in life and it's reoccurring over the, you know, a certain period of a lifespan. What's really cool as far as what has really helped me in this field, because I think there was a time that we believed that there were certain things we couldn't impact, certain disorders that we had very limited ways of helping people with. But there's, again, all this research, and you're seeing a lot more what's called trauma-informed therapies, so trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, which has been around since the 70s, but again, that's based on our mind's ability to neurologically process traumas and then to heal. And so a trauma really is an event that is so out of our own capacity to deal with, because it's something that shouldn't happen, that in the moment we have a reaction to deal with it, but over time, if we don't somehow learn to process it, then we get stuck. And again, there's these ability now to engage a person's experience with trauma that allows them to bring it up in a safe situation to process it, and then over time they can actually engage certain practices that help them slow down triggers like heart rates or anxiety attack, or help them deal with the autonomic nervous system that gives them a sense of power in response to traumatic events. And so for me personally, seeing a client's ability to recognize their own ability to manage some of these things that stem from traumatic events is super powerful for them. Simple stuff, but again, it's not easy because it's counter to what we've learned for, you know, most of our lifetime. But that's, I've seen very powerful for the clients that I've worked with.
And Jessica, on that question of like across the lifespan, I mean, one of the things that I think about is, you know, and the concept of intergenerational trauma really makes me think about it even more, is that trauma for the most part is an interpersonal event. There are, you know, earthquakes, hurricanes, other kinds of events that can be traumatizing to people, global pandemics. But most of the trauma that Alaskans experience are the things that happen between people, you know? And so it's like in the challenge is that it's also in relationships with other people where we heal. And that's, when you think about that across the lifespan, you know, the biggest protective factors for young kids, for all kids, is their caregivers, the people who are part of their family, part of their community. And so when we are working with children, particularly young children, who've been impacted by trauma, a lot of our work is with the caregivers. You know, it's with the family, it's with the extended family, it's with community members that are important to them. Because the kind of double-edged sword of trauma is that trauma happens in between people, but it also resiliency and healing happens in relationships and with people. And I think, you know, some of the treatment approaches, like Julie was talking about, you know, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, there's child-parent psychotherapy, which is an early childhood adaptation of the same kind of concept, that build on, like Julie said, EMDR and other trauma processing models that have been developing over 30 plus years that lean on, you know, what we've known for thousands of years, right? The earliest human beings have been trying to process difficult experiences for as long as human beings have been around. It's in all great literature. It's on, you know, chalk drawings on caves that are 15,000 years old. I mean, human beings have been trying to sort through how these difficult experiences, and they do it together. And so when we think about treatment, you know, I think earlier, maybe Julie was talking about, you know, that some of the challenges of the Western medical model, you know, there are things we can learn from science and research that really help us do treatment better. But, you know, what our grandparents knew and their grandparents knew is that you heal in relationships with other people. And so across the lifespan, that's what we focus on. And for kids, it's about, you know, restoring that protective bubble that your parents and your family provide. And so, you know, this goes back to a couple earlier questions you had about, you know, people being concerned about being judged. And I think Pete just said it really well. It's like, we're not here to judge your family or you. And if that you think that's happening in therapy, then you're not getting therapy. We need to adjust, you know? And really, actually, we're not there to judge your family. We know that the only way that you're going to recover from this is in your relationships with other people. And so we're actually kind of taking the opposite perspective and saying, so what is going on that we can build on here in this family or in this community?
Yeah, and if I could just kind of pick up on something that kind of came to mind as Josh was talking there, is sometimes parents bring their kids to therapy because they're concerned about a behavior, or they're concerned about what events children have been through might be affecting them. But as far as what a parent can do to support their child, seeking out services for themselves when they find themselves in a place where they're behaving in a way they're not proud of, or feeling as though they're overwhelmed. We often don't talk enough, I think, about how a parent's ability to manage their own life experiences impacts their children. And I think it's a real gift that we give our children when we make a concerted effort to heal our own wounds so that those wounds don't get passed from our generation to the next.
I wanted to ask you all, because you're all people who work within communities and work with families, and Josh touched on this a little bit in his last answer, but what's different about a community behavioral health center or community-based services versus residential services? I'll just leave it there. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, I can say a couple of things. I mean, one thing to think about is, you know, in behavioral health systems, you have the same thing you have in all health systems, which is you have kind of levels of care. So, you know, if you need to go to the hospital, you need to go to the hospital. But, and that's the way I think about higher levels of behavioral health care. It's like going to the hospital. If you in some situations, that's what you need. But, you know, part of why I love working community mental health is, you know, I really enjoy working with families to help them keep their kids home in their community, with the people they're familiar with. And so that's, I know that's the focus of behavioral health providers at all levels of care, but I worked in different systems. I love working community mental health because I love being in communities. And I think all the families that I've worked with over the years, they want their kids at home and going to school and visiting, you know, with their aunties. And as a community mental health provider, that's like right in the front of what I'm working and my teams are working on every day. And I really enjoy it. And it's just the right place for me to be. Cause it's just right at my core values. And so, and the teams that I work with, you know, all of our providers are clinicians. I mean, it's when they talk about what they love about their job, it's, you know, helping families stay together. And so it's a really, the behavioral health field, there's a lot of different places you can be, but this is the place that I want to be and the teams that I work with want to be.
Does anyone else have anything they want to add? No? Okay. I want to, Julie mentioned a while back, Julie mentioned that sometimes people come to you for services because at some point the court system has gotten involved. So they're not necessarily choosing all on their own to be there. And yet you need to work with them. You need to all be working together to improve things. I guess I just, is that an extra barrier, or is there a different way that you would approach things in that setting?
So I was fortunate, speaking of residential, I had an amazing, a powerful experience, I would say, when I first got to Bethel working at the Yagnarvik Healing Center, which used to be PATC. So that's a residential program for adults. And a lot of them were referred from the court systems, had actually done some jail time, but also the courts got involved because secondary to their substance use, you know, which makes sense. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that substance use disorders are a primary factor in a lot of the court issues that we see out here. And trying to tease out the need for help for the substance use disorder while still requiring accountability has not been necessarily well figured out, except for, I will say, therapeutic court programs. I think we're a really powerful step towards doing that. And we've had therapeutic court here for some time. It was recently suspended, which I'm hoping to see that get back on track in the near future. But recidivism rates for substance use disorder recovery have traditionally been really low, but in therapeutic court, because those programs are like a year and a half, tend to be 50% or higher as far as people maintaining the benefits of having went through a recovery program. And again, when you think about recovery, a A lot of residential programs are 6 to 8 weeks. If you're lucky, you remember traditional 21 to 28 day. And it takes 8 weeks for the brain to actually start responding to new learning, new habits. And so, I think, again, just not criminalizing or villainizing people who struggle with substance use disorders, but still recognizing that there has to be accountability for behaviors. It continues to be a challenge. But like I said, I think the therapeutic court program is an example of one good program that addresses that as well as anything I've seen.
Josh mentioned our global pandemic a little bit ago, and we haven't focused on that in this conversation, but I did want to ask if you have seen more need for services or different needs than you typically would in these last couple of months. What have you noticed that's different, if anything?
Well, I'm curious to hear what's happening in Western Alaska. I can talk a little bit about just what we've seen at a statewide level. We're working with about 500 families right now, mostly in interior and South Central Alaska, but what we saw, and some of this is really local, too, but we saw in the first couple of weeks of hunker down, and I used to use that term all the time, now it has a totally different meaning, but we saw families hunkering down, before the hunker down order, basically saying, we're all going to stay home and kind of ride this out. And then what's happened is that can work, but it doesn't work forever. And so a lot of families, we saw a decrease in families accessing services for a couple of weeks. And then that went on for about a month or so. And then families were like, the challenges we had before COVID-19, they didn't go away because of COVID-19. And we still need help. And then COVID-19 just layers on a bunch on top of that, especially with the disruption in schools. It's just been a huge, huge change for families. I just... yesterday was meeting with a bunch of principals in Fairbanks and talking with them about their students and what it looks like on their side of all this. But one of the things that we've seen is that families kind of tried to ride it out for a while, and now those needs are kind of just building up. And so we're seeing actually more demand for a need for services than we saw pre-COVID-19. And despite the access challenges, more and more families are calling us than they were before this all happened. So that's what we're kind of seeing, but I'm curious what you are seeing in Western Alaska.
Well, I can say that, down here in Bristol Bay, it's about to be fishing season. And anybody who's at all familiar with the Bristol Bay fishery knows that about this time of year, 10,000-15,000 people descend on us for the salmon fishing. And this year has obviously been very complicated. There have been some really, I think, painful divisions in communities in Bristol Bay regarding what position on whether there should be a fishing season this year, whether outsiders should be welcome to the community for fishing season or not. And unfortunately, some of those divisions have added to a sense of isolation and conflict, which has been a really, I think, unfortunate side effect that I'm hoping will heal quickly after this summer's fishing season. Certainly, when people are struggling and you add, I mean, the word global pandemic is pretty effective at hijacking our reactive parts of our brain. And anytime you add something like that, when someone's baseline, maybe someone's already maxed out, you've just put a huge burden on them. And I think we're seeing that. I think initially, similar to what Josh was reporting, we saw people kind of not engaging, almost like one of those things that happens sometimes where people say, I don't have time to take care of myself. And that, like Josh said, works for a bit, and then you end up maxed out and maybe more maxed out than you would have been if you had engaged in sort of an ongoing way. And so we're seeing that now, and we're seeing a lot of people coming in with, you know, increased anxiety and stress, conflicts with loved ones, and difficult questions about how to keep themselves and their families safe. All this is happening, of course, in the context of Alaska Native people, and rural Alaska has seen global pandemics before, devastating consequences. You know, in the 1918 pandemic, 80% of the Alaskans who died were Alaska Native, and those are not forgotten losses. And so I think it's impossible to talk about what's happening now without acknowledging the context of that.
Jen, it sounds like in Bethel, you were already having a tough winter with travel before this hit. So you maybe have had this, you know, more extended tough time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the beautiful thing about the YK Delta, and this is the only place I've lived in the state, so this is my only experience, but the resiliency out here is just amazing. And people know how to come together and get through really challenging times. And, you know, I agree with Josh and Pete, you know, there's the loss of routine, the loss of those physical connections through the whole pandemic have been really hard. You know, Julie and I have, you know, a lot of people just talk about loss and grief and anxiety about that. But what I also see is people coming together and finding ways to move forward and to work together to find safe ways to move forward, even though things are still kind of up in the air and there's still some fear about what may happen in the future. You know, when the river was breaking up this year, there was a lot happening and there was some concerns about flooding, and people's minds, even though the pandemic was still going on and it still was affecting everybody, people's minds were shifting with that natural routine that can't ever go away. The season changing, the river breaking up, people getting ready to go up to their fish camps. Smelt arrived a couple days ago, and so everyone was down by the seawall wearing their masks and doing the social distancing thing, but coming down with their families and their, you know, close friends and smelting. And, you know, so yeah, there has definitely been a heightened level of stress, anxiety, loss, and grief about the way things kind of used to be. But also there's just this huge level of resiliency that you see everywhere you look. And people coming together to move forward. So, you know, it's definitely challenging times, but, you know, people have gotten through a lot of challenging times in the past.
What a great note to end our conversation on. That's just a really nice thought and a great way to end our conversation today about mental health for Mental Health Awareness Month. Thanks all of you for joining us. We've been talking with Pete Tallman, who's a therapist in the Bristol Bay region with Chamai Community Health Center, and Julie Thompson and Jen Peeks from Bethel Family Clinic, as well as Josh Arvidson from Anchorage Community Mental Health Services, soon to be Alaska Behavioral Health. And I'm Jessica Cochran. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday on KYUK, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Catch us every Wednesday at 10 a.m.